Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I am joined by our Deputy Editor and Nolan superfan, Matt Matem.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are talking stealing from sets and Bond movies with Barbie director Greta Gerwig, as well as quantum physics and world-changing events with Oppenheimer star and director Cillian Murphy and Christopher Nolan. Plus, we'll be weighing up on both those films as they go head-to-head at the box office for Barbenheimer.
Can I come to your house tonight?
Sure. I don't have anything big planned, just a giant blowout party with all the Barbies and planned choreography and a bespoke song. You should stop by.
So cool. Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Barbie in the real world. That's impossible.
If this got out, this could mean extremely weird things for our world.
This would be catastrophic!
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.
Oh, I'm having so much fun!
Well, Barbie, we're just getting started.
Oh, I love you, Ken!
But before we get onto that, Matt, before we get onto the Clash of the Titans, the plastic doll versus quantum physics, what else have you been watching this week?
I mean, it's hard to think of anything else this week. It's a very, very exciting week to be on the podcast with these films. But I have also seen another new release that's out this week that's probably likely to get somewhat overshadowed by these two sort of films.
Behemoths.
Yes, by these two behemoths. And, you know, especially because obviously the Barbenheimer discourse has become so strong and they've become so sort of interlinked, really. But there's a film out called My Name is Alfred Hitchcock, which is a documentary directed by Mark Cousins, the famous documentary, the story of film guy. And it's quite an interesting concept for a documentary because it's sort of like a video essay on the films and themes of Alfred Hitchcock, but presented in such a way where, do you remember TV impersonator slash funny man Alistair McGowan?
Of course.
He basically is doing an impression of Alfred Hitchcock as a narrator. So the whole film is narrated, in inverted commas, by Alfred Hitchcock in a very, very good impersonation, I must say. So that gives it a different sort of cheeky flavour, and it's kind of, you know, a fun way in. And it basically kind of picks on these six kind of key themes and concerns and delves into those. You get a lot of clips looking back at the old films. It was one of those things for me that I found this, I really like Hitchcock, obviously, who doesn't? And I enjoy a video essay as well, you know, I like that as a format. So it was fun for me to just, you know, see some of those old clips, revisit the films with sort of slightly fresh eyes, see these, you know, the sort of links they were drawing between them. But I would also say it was one of those documentaries that never fully electrified me, if you know what I mean. It didn't kind of build to any like hugely exciting reveal. It was just very sort of, you know, nicely put together, interesting, enjoyed watching it, but I just wasn't, you know, wasn't electrified, but I wasn't blown away by it. And so I do think it will struggle to get much oxygen this week probably, but you know, check it out if that sounds up your street. It's like I say, it was an entertaining couple of hours.
Speaking of entertaining couple of hours, I was at a junket for Barbie this week, as you were at a junket for Oppenheimer. Mine was very pink. When I got out of the lift, the entire lift vestibule was covered in pink balloons. There was a pink carpet. I was given a Barbie pink hairbrush. There was Barbie pink popcorn, sweeties in jars, all pink, pink roses, pink everything. What were they giving you at Oppenheimer?
Nothing really. It was just a classy hotel junket setting for that one, and some nice big Oppenheimer posters. And there was actually, they did have some nice nibbles on the side, I must say. There was because as often these junkets take place in sort of fancy hotels in central London, and so when you're waiting around, sometimes you have a waiting room that, you know, with like tea and water and, you know, occasional snacks. And the time I arrived for my interviews, there was these quite fancy little patisseries actually, which were enjoyable. Not Oppenheimer themed in any way. It was extremely tasty, but obviously, as you know, Jane, you have to sort of save these for after the interview so that you don't go in with like fully chocolatey teeth or like stains down your top. Yeah, but a nice little treat when you do get a nice hotel biscuit.
And also probably the last time we will talk to actors for some time, because the strike went into effect just as we were doing our junket, in fact. And now we are all in the same position as the actors. And I think it's quite interesting to sort of think about the knock-on effects of this. It's not just the livelihoods of writers and actors that are at stake. It's all of the peripheral services that feed into those roles. And we are part of that ecosystem. So we are now in a tricky position of trying to create a magazine about film without any writers or actors, which is going to be quite a challenge. And I don't know what we're going to do.
It's daunting. It's sort of daunting for the festivals, which is something we're always very excited about and sort of love to go to and have plans, you know, to go to Venice and Toronto, you know, coming up in the autumn. But it's nerve-wracking times, because obviously we hope to see a resolution, but if it ends up dragging on, who knows what will happen with, you know, the festivals, the autumn film schedule. I mean, for so many reasons, we're hoping for a swift resolution, not least our own personal reasons.
Yeah. And also for many reasons, this is going to be an absolute barnstormer of a pod. This is absolutely the last time we were going to have actors and writers on it for a while. So shall we get on to what we are going to be talking about? It's time to get back in your box. It's this. You can find me under the
lights, diamonds under my eyes. This is the best day ever.
It is the best day ever. So is yesterday, and so is tomorrow, and every day from now until forever. Yes! You guys ever think about dying?
This is Barbie, Greta Gerwig's take on Mattel's ubiquitous doll, starring Margot Robbie as Barbie and Ryan Gosling as Ken. Barbie has an existential crisis in Barbieland and must travel to the real world to put things back in order. But before we talk more about that, shall we have a little listen to what Greta Gerwig, the writer and director of Barbie, had to say when I sat down with her at the pinkest junket ever last week?
What do I have to do?
You have to go to the real world.
You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours.
The first one, the high heel.
You have to want to know, okay? Do it again.
Closer I am fine. Closer I am fine.
I'm coming with you.
Okay.
So congratulations on this film.
You.
Quote Ken, it's sublime. It's
sublime.
And I'm going to be using sublime for the rest of the summer about everything. But I just wanted to talk to you about the start of this when you came on board as the writer and obviously Margot as producer. When did that change for you that you decided I have to direct it and she has to star?
In my mind, she was always a star. So even when we were writing it, it's for Margot. That's the way I was sort of thinking of it. But in terms of directing, it was like, it was as we were finishing the script, I loved it. I loved this crazy madcap thing that we wrote. I just thought, well, they'll never let us make it. But if they do let someone make it, I don't want it to be anyone but me. So then it was really out of the script.
You say it's madcap, and you wrote it with your husband whilst you're in sort of lockdown. Do you think that totally inspired how you wrote it, and it would be a totally different project if you hadn't written it in lockdown?
It was so informed by that degree of isolation and not being in any sort of community with anyone. And my favorite thing to do, his favorite thing to do, is to go to a movie theater with people and sit in the dark and be transported, and nothing that wasn't happening anymore. And so I think there was a little bit of a feeling of like, who knows when this will ever come back or if it will ever come back. And I think because of that, it was almost a go for broke. Why not?
Tell me about going to the visit that you did to go to Mattel. So you went to Mattel to look at their sort of archives, and you found these crazy dolls that you've put in, which I had to Google, and I love the end credits because it says, you know, these are real. It's astonishing. How did that open up the project to you in a sort of creative fashion?
Well, so much of that, like, initial visit to Mattel opened up the project to me. This was before I kind of knew what we were going to do, but I was born in 83, so I had some memory of, like, she has friends, right? Like, are there... And they were like, no, there are no friends anymore. These are all Barbies, and these are all Kens. All of these women are Barbie, and Barbie is all of these women. And I was like, that is a totally strange thing, even sort of philosophically. And then, you know, in 465 years of history, you know, of the doll, there's just all these fascinating dead ends, which I, instead of pretending that they never existed, I sort of love them because it reminds you that, you know, this is only ever just made by people. People made all this up. There was just no Barbie. She wasn't discovered. She was invented. And I think it's a reminder of that we make these dolls.
Speaking of Ken, let's talk about Ryan Gosling. Amazing performance. Why was it so important that the Kennergy was, you know, as strong as the Barbie energy?
Well, I mean, when we were writing it, it was all of, there was something about the forgottenness of Ken and the sort of that he's an accessory to Barbie that felt so much like, well, that is fascinating. I mean, even in a reversal of like in some movies where there might be a girlfriend or a wife part, I mean, like, Ken's like the girlfriend or the wife, like just little to no interior motivation apparently other than being there for Barbie. And it just felt like, well, that's funny and tragic, both of those things. And so that felt rich in terms of, you know, psychologically for a character. And then I really always imagined Ryan, and I didn't know Ryan. I'd never worked with him. I'd never even met him. And I think he thought when we first spoke that, you know, I was like, I've written this for you. And I think he kind of thought that's just a thing she's saying. But that wasn't true. And no one, I really, it was like him all along. And I was right about that. but it took him a while to figure out that I was right and that he should just come be in the future I saw.
Tell me about the dream house. What was it like when you got that built? And was there a favorite aspect of it for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was extraordinary. It was, I mean, it was the sets, all the sets, all the different kind of places, the sort of dream house, the Supreme Court, you know, the Oval Office, all the transportation sequences, the beach. They were all, you know, we had about a year, Sarah Greenwood and I, who did the sets, to talk about everything before we were even technically in, like, proper pre-production. So we had all this time to work out all the oddities of what we were looking at. So it was everything from like all these details of like, instead of objects in some places, it's like a decal, which is just so clever and just right. And that's how toys are. Like it was, everything was just made perfectly. And it was all in service of making, you know, a life-size dollhouse. I stole from Kate McKinnon's house on the hill. She has a little snow globe with her house on the hill in the snow globe. I took that. Actually, well, they knew I took it. I said,
You asked permission, of course.
Yes, of course. I mean, the last thing I want to do is mess up my own archive.
Speaking of which, is there potential for a sequel? We leave this on an open end. There could be more adventures for Barbie.
Anything's possible. I would say today, the main thing I'm focused on is the next, you know, 15 days, and then I'll see what happens after that. I mean, I would say I loved making it so much. I mean, it was such a joyful experience. It was so wonderful. It was so, you know, really allowed us to go in all these different directions that I don't think any other movie would have afforded those opportunities. I mean, it was almost like I got to live out my dream of making, you know, a 1950s soundstage musical.
Yeah. Speaking of making worlds, you're going into Narnia.
Oh my gosh, yes.
What can you tell us about that? And is it going to be as, you know, wondrous as this?
I haven't even really started wrapping my arms around it, but I'm properly scared of it, which feels like a good place to start. I think when I'm scared, it's always a good sign. Maybe when I stop being scared, it'll be like, maybe I shouldn't do that one. But yeah, no, I'm terrified of it. It's extraordinary. And it's exciting, yeah. It's definitely, I mean, you know, I hope to make all different kinds of movies in the course of my, you know, the time I get to make movies, which is, you know, it's a long time, but it's also limited. So I think, you know, I want to do sort of big things and small things and everywhere in between. And having another big canvas is exciting and also daunting.
You could do Bond. They've got an opening.
Oh, my God. No, we're going to just stick with some lions, some dolls for the moment. But, yeah, I mean, you never know. I really like Barbara Broccoli, so.
So that is Greta on all things Barbie. Matt, do you just want to give us a quick pressé of what this is about and where this existential crisis takes us?
I mean, unless you've been under a rock or, you know, still in your box or however you want to say it, for the past recent months, you'll kind of probably have some grasp of Barbie. You've probably seen some kind of advertising for it. And it obviously is a strange concept, isn't it? When you sort of first think of a Barbie movie, it's just hard to imagine what that would be. And then, especially if you know Greta Gerwig's work and you think, like, what kind of attracted her to this? But as you mentioned, it's kind of an existential crisis. So we begin in Barbie land with kind of Margot Robbie as the stereotypical Barbie and Ryan Gosling as her Ken. She's just enjoying life there. It's sort of, you know, perfect pink manicured existence. Every day is the same. Every day is a party. You know, she wakes up every day and just goes about her dream house and then goes to the beach, parties in the evening with all her pals. And then the existential crisis, again, you've probably seen this in the trailers, but starts because Barbie's famously sort of tiptoe feet go flat. And then it starts throwing all these kind of problems her way, and it sends her sort of spiraling, thinking about death and thinking about all these things which had never troubled her before. So she goes to Weird Barbie, who's played by Kate McKinnon. There's just absolutely loads of different Barbies in this world. They're all called Barbie, and basically discovers that, yeah, she has to journey to the real world to sort of put something right that's causing this. It's to do with who's playing with her in the real world, is sending these sort of bad vibes back. So she's got to go journey to the real world and sort out the problems going on over there in order to get her life back to how it was, and, you know, go back to living her sort of tiptoe happy existence from before, where she's just sort of completely untroubled. So she takes this journey over into the real world with Ken in tow. And then probably wouldn't say much more than that, really, you know, if you want to sort of enjoy what the film has to offer, because as you may also have heard, it is a sort of odd and surprising film. So I think it's kind of best to let things play out from there, really.
Yeah, I mean, really, all of that is in the trailer. And it's a little bit teasing of something that it actually isn't. And it is best to go in and not really know the actual mechanics of what happens. But suffice to say, it is a film that is about a doll and a mass-produced doll that takes stabs at sort of corporations and, you know, money-grabbing CEOs and plastic life and patriarchy, but also manages to make it a absolute journey that becomes ultimately a really profound experience. And that is not what I thought. I did not think that the Barbie movie would have me crying and really thinking about my own relationships with my parents, my own mortality, how to live the best Barbie life, how to ensure you have your own Kennergy going in your world. All of these things you come out with, as well as having had a damn good time. Did you like it, or did it have problems for you?
I thought it was very, very enjoyable. Like, I went to a sort of the big press screening last night as we record this, and I saw some sort of extremely enthusiastic reactions afterwards. And I wasn't quite in that bracket. For me, if we're talking sort of star ratings, it was more of a 4 than a 5 for me. But that said, I really, really enjoyed it. Yeah, it really sort of surpassed and twisted those expectations you might have for a film based on a toy. And call me a snob or whatever, but I always can't help but feel a bit like, oh, like when you see Mattel, or, you know, in the case of Transformers, when you see Hasbro sort of pop up at the beginning, it kind of really makes you think, oh, is this going to be a real exercise in corporate branding or whatever? But Greta Gerwig really has managed to sort of get away with a lot. There's like a lot of kind of jabs at Barbie. It's a very sort of progressive take on the material, which you sort of, again, you might not have expected if you just know the stereotypical Barbie toys, you know, and, you know, didn't really know the approach they were going for with the film. And it's funny, it's well done. There's some really fun touches with how they create this Barbie land that sort of, you know, tie into how children kind of play with them. There's all sort of fun references like that. And even someone like me, who didn't grow up with Barbies at all, really, you get an understanding of that world. You kind of get the jokes. You still can appreciate these odd variations they had on the Barbie dolls. You know, these old random, there's the dog, you know,
there's pooping, Midge, there's Tana the pooping dog. Yeah. Yeah, Midge the pregnant friend. There's like earring magic Ken. There's Video Barbie, who literally has a video in her back. the craziest ideas that Mattel had in putting out these dolls are all within this world. And also, it really addresses, doesn't it, that the arguments for and against Barbie. Mm. If you love Barbie, it's all here. All of the little toast, the way she drinks, the way she opens her fridge and it's all little decals, her little car and the fact that she never wears rings and her hands are slightly bent because she doesn't have individual fingers as a doll. All of those little touches are there. But if you also find her a really irritating representation of womanhood, that if she was a real woman, couldn't actually stand and support her body weight with the huge boobs and the tiny waist, then they also address all of that as well. And commercialization of childhood and patriarchy and incel societies and just the whole gamut of growing up. This is really about growing up. And it's not just for women, it is for men as well. And the interpersonal relationships between men and women and how we could all really do better. We could actually all learn from Ken and Barbie and not define ourselves by the Ken or the Barbie in our own lives. And that, I think, is so well done. The only thing I'd say about it that I don't know what kids would get out of this. This is a 12A and it looks fantastic. It's super pink and all the clothes are amazing and the little shoes and all the accessories. If you're into Barbie and you love it, you're going to love that. But what are they going to think is going on with the rest of it?
That was one of my qualms you've just hit on. And again, maybe this is a bit of a boring thing to say, but I, especially before seeing it, I thought, are children going to get anything out of this? Because this is ultimately, it's a children's brand. And I think like a lot of children are going to see marketing for this bright pink Barbie film and want to see it, aren't they? It's like a film about a toy. And so I sort of questioned before going in, like, is this going to be suitable for children like at all? Sort of watching it, I came away, it was more, probably more suitable for children than I had anticipated beforehand, because there is just so much bright colour there that is really fun when you're in that world. And there's kind of silly moments. And it kind of made me think a bit back to films I just watched inappropriate. Like, I mean, some much more extremely inappropriate than this, like say something like RoboCop was one I always think of, that I almost thought it was like a children's film when I was younger, because he seemed sort of like a, you know, like a comic book character or something. And obviously this sort of satire just completely went over my head. So I wonder if there'll be sort of young children who'll do a similar thing with Barbie, where they just will just enjoy seeing like this representation of Barbie played very well by Margot Robbie, who kind of, you know, plays different shades of this character throughout the film as it progresses. And so maybe they'll literally just enjoy it, seeing a real Barbie, you know, alive and doing things. And maybe there'll be enough colour, enough pop music, enough silly bits to sort of entertain them whilst other things fly over their heads. But there's definitely some sort of some language and sex references and things like that, which I think, to me, it's pushing it for a younger audience, because it is a 12A, so obviously you can take any age child really accompanied by an adult. But obviously there's that expectation it will be children at the older end of that scale, you know, I guess like 8+ or whatever. But you could imagine a few awkward questions being asked afterwards.
And some non-awkward, like, Mummy, what is patriarchy? Mm. Not a bad conversation to have when you're going out to
exactly.
Cinema.
And maybe it'll end up being like a useful tool, but there's sort of, you know, references to their genitals or lack thereof. There's a lot of, again, you get this in the trailer, but there's a lot of innuendo about beaching off as well, like is Ken's job just being beach. And so there's a lot of, you know, talking about beaching guys off.
I will beach
like
everyone
that,
on the beach, yeah.
Which, again, maybe it's just that thing that if you're a young kid and you see that, you just laugh because they're just talking silly, basically, and you don't really know what the adults are sort of sniggering at. Yes, but that was one qualm. And then another thing, which I don't know if I'd go full on to say this was a full-on qualm for me, but for all its kind of invention and oddness and, you know, being really kind of unexpected for a Barbie film, there were quite a few things in it that were familiar to me, such as the Lego movie being one thing that is sort of inescapable. It felt very the Lego movie to me, because when you think you had this main character exists who just goes about this world, you know, not realizing what they're really a part of and does the same thing every day. There was something that felt familiar, that waking up in the dream house doing that sort of stuff. It felt like what Emmett did in the Lego movie.
And in Free Guy.
The fact you have, Free Guy as well. The fact you have Will Ferrell as well as the sort of, you know, the nominal baddie, I suppose, the sort of the big CEO. He's obviously kind of fulfills that role in the Lego movie as well. So that, I didn't know if that was like an actual reference. And then,
well, it is a Warner Brothers film, isn't it?
And thinking of Will Ferrell as well, it reminded me a bit of Elf, especially sort of in the way they cross over into the real world. Then just that, you know, that classic fish out of water comedy of these sort of immature characters who just aren't prepared for the, you know, the harsh real world coming in. Felt a bit Elf to me. There was definitely some Toy Story, particularly Toy Story 2 in there for me as well.
Yeah.
So there, it definitely strongly reminded me of a few other films at points. And there's
and none
there's
of those films you've mentioned are bad. So that's a high recommendation.
There are homages to other films as well. So, which also I imagine will go over the younger viewers' heads. Yes. So certain things like that felt a bit familiar to me. But that said, I really enjoyed it. It was a film I sort of, you know, had a smile on my face all throughout. A lot of funny quotable lines, some really enjoyable visuals. I actually thought as well, someone we haven't mentioned, but America Ferrera, who's a character who we sort of run into in the real world, I thought she was really, really good here and really sort of grounded the film and just brought something really, really nice to the film. She was one of the really valuable players for me as well. Gosling is sort of a standout.
I mean, we have to talk about Gosling, well, don't we? I mean, when he's not on screen, you're like, when's he coming back? Because he is just brilliant. And that's a little bit of a conflicting feeling when it's a film that celebrates, you know, female experience, to have the guy be such a incredibly strong role in it. But he is so good and so multi-layered as well. Like, he has this arc. Barbie has an arc that we won't go into any spoilers, but he equally has one that's just as strong and is quite emotionally impactful, that even though he's busy beaching and, you know, loving horses and whatever else he's doing and shouting sublime, which is something I think we should adopt in the office about things that are great, he is having this existential crisis of his own as well. And I just thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, he's just very, very good in it. And from sort of, yeah, musical numbers to silly moments to just sort of throwing himself into the just that sort of naivety of the character and the sort of ego and everything, the way he just lives to sort of, you know, have Barbie gaze upon him, just immensely enjoyable, really. And there are a lot of enjoyable performances throughout, because, like I was mentioned earlier, there's just so many different Barbies played by different people.
Emerald Fennell is playing Midge. Got who else in the Barbie land?
Among the Kens, you've got Kingsley Benadir, Simu Liu from Shang-Chi. He was very enjoyable, I thought. Shuti Gatwa, who's the new Doctor Who. And then he's also joined by his sex education co-star, Emma Mackey, who's a Barbie as well.
A former wrestling star as a cameo. There is Michael Cera as Alan, who I didn't even know existed in Mattel land, who was created as Ken's best friend, who can wear all of Ken's clothes. So Michael Cera is this sort of disenfranchised character who lives in a sort of netherworld, neither a Ken nor a Barbie, and sort of floats around in between and is very much the voice of the audience in this. He's so good as well.
Just absolutely perfect casting of that Michael Cera. There's lots to enjoy, especially for like an adult audience.
Yeah, and a load of bangers of songs really very as well. Enjoyable. You've got this beautiful Billie Eilish song, What Was I Made For? That I don't know if you managed to stifle the tears when that was playing, but yeah. I wept like a baby.
I actually did stifle tears throughout this, to be honest. I don't know if it's just, if it's like a classic bloke thing or whatever, but I found it touching in places, but I never got the full threat of actually weeping into my popcorn. But yeah, there was definitely a few touching moments in there.
I certainly got something in my eye. Mm. And then you've got I'm a Barbie Girl does play in there. It's just amazing. And one of the things I love from a production point of view is obviously the dream house is amazing, but there's this one point where a ambulance is called and the whole back of it opens and it is a full functioning version of that toy ambulance that Barbie had, with pink beds and all of the paraphernalia. It's absolutely amazing. Absolute shout out to Sarah Greenwood, the production designer. It's incredible to see. I want to watch it again just to watch everything that's going on in the background and look at the saucepans and look at the toasters and look at the little waffles on plates and all of the detail that's in this. It's incredible to look at.
And I don't know if anyone else will care about this, but again, if I'm talking a minor qualm, it just 100% plays by its own rules and is just like, come along, enjoy this. This is like Greta Gerwig and sort of co-written by Noah Baumbach. Their take on what this Barbie movie is going to be. It's sort of subversive, interesting, funny, but it just bumbles along to its own rules. And there's no real sort of logic or sense to it, I thought. And then even once you get to the real world's not particularly real. It's not like they enter this really sort of gritty real world. That felt quite, still feels very heightened when they're in that real world. So it's almost just like, yeah, it just felt like this fun confection that's just been created to sort of blast at you. You enjoy it. You enjoy these themes they explore, these moments. Obviously, Toy Story falls apart when you think about it for more than 5 seconds. But I thought this even more so. Maybe that's just me being a Grinch.
Well, I think maybe you are. You mentioned that Greta wants people to come along and enjoy this ride. Do you think there's a possibility for this to go to a sequel? And do you think that it's going to make enough money to actually warrant that?
Two tricky questions. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it makes enough money to warrant it, simply because it's just had such a marketing blitz. And the fact that like the branding is such an easy sell that you can just sort of slap pink on everything and it feels like Barbie. And obviously everyone, even like I say, someone like me who didn't grow up playing with Barbies, you knew people who did, you know, people in your family and stuff had them. It's just such a huge kind of cultural icon that just everyone knows to a more or less of a degree. You're sort of familiar with it. And it really feels like they've, yeah, like kind of infiltrated that conversation this summer. It's fun. You've got the soundtrack that you mentioned. That's obviously just going to be really big this summer. So it's going to be like, you know, there's the tie-in merchandise. So it's going to be a big talking point thing. So I think a lot of people will go and see it to be part of the conversation. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if people take their families to this, you know, how wide the age range actually ends up being for this. And also I'll be intrigued to see what repeat viewing it gets as well, because of it being unusual and perhaps not what family audiences especially are expecting. I'll be interested to see how that does long-term at the box office, but also obviously it faces big competition this weekend in the form of another film, which we're about to discuss.
Yes. What film's that, Matt?
It's Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer.
Well, more on that. But for now, shall we say, if you do fancy Barbie, and you really should, it's out in cinemas on Friday. Go see it on a big screen. Take your friends, you know, dress in pink, the whole shebang. It really should be a celebratory event. I loved it. Right, so shall we talk about Barbie's competition then? It's this.
We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb,
they have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope.
All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here.
A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
So this is Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's study of the titular scientists' race to build the atomic bomb during World War II, and the subsequent fallout in the McCarthy years afterwards. Now, Matt, you sat down with the star of this, Cillian Murphy, who plays Oppenheimer, and writer-director Christopher Nolan last week to talk about the film. So let's have a listen to what you chatted about.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
To begin with, Christopher Nolan has talked a lot about how he wrote this script in the first person. So how did that sort of present itself when you actually read the script?
Yeah, I'd never read a script like that before. I never read a script written in the first person. And, you know, you realise then that it was going to be completely subjective and very much Oppenheimer's point of view, and that the audience would be with him, kind of on his shoulder, as he experienced and struggled with all these huge kind of moral and ethical and paradoxical dilemmas. So I kind of knew that it would be very much an interior performance as well as an exterior performance, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
It obviously covers a large period of Oppenheimer's life.
Yeah.
Did you film in anything like chronological order, or were you jumping about all over the place?
We did some of the young stuff at the beginning, you know, when he's studying, he's a student. But then after that, no, it was mostly kind of out of order. But when you have someone as brilliant as Chris, you rely on him and you rely on the work that you've done. But that's generally the way films are shot, always out of sequence.
Is it sort of helpful to you to have someone like Oppenheimer where there's just so much material out there available to sort of research?
It is very helpful, and I did an awful lot of reading, but ultimately it's about the script, you know, it's about what's on the page, and that's Chris's version of the story. So that's what you've got to serve. That's your primary resource, you know.
Was it sort of heavy going playing this character where there's just obviously so much going on in his mind?
It was, but they're the kind of jobs I love. They're the kind of characters that I really enjoy portraying. It was amazing hanging out with these fantastic actors, the best actors in the world, and a lot of laughing and a lot of joking around, because you have to have some kind of levity when you're dealing with this sort of material.
I read a quote from Matt Damon recently saying that you couldn't join them for a lot of dinners because there was so much going on in your brain. Was that a fair comment from him?
Yeah, I mean, he's played those sorts of parts before. You know, Emily's played those parts. They've all done those sorts of parts with their big, big parts, and they require an awful lot of focus and they kind of consume you. And, you know, so I just had, I was in most days and I was skipping dinner anyway most of the time. So, but it's been great to hang out with them now, these days, you know, on the tour.
You mentioned kind of not wanting to be pretentious earlier. And it reminded me of something you said when we spoke previously for the magazine. You said kind of you're a fan of going into a film without any notions of actors' twaddle beforehand.
I think it comes from my belief that I think acting is about instinct and emotion and not about intellect. And I've always believed that. And you can talk and talk and talk and talk about it, and we can sit here and talk about acting and we can talk about filmmaking, but ultimately it's about how it connects with you on a gut level. There's so much written about it and so much discourse and so much analysis of acting, but ultimately it's not intellectual to me.
This is obviously your sixth film with Christopher Nolan. Is there something about the way you both work that kind of you connected straight away?
There seems to be something. It's developed, of course. Like any working partnership or any friendship, it's kind of developed. And I think we have similar tastes, you know, and we have a very good shorthand. And most of all, we really trust each other. I do anything for Chris, you know. When you have that kind of core understanding between each other, you can do good work, I think.
Where do you see Oppenheimer sort of sitting in the canon of his work? Do you see it as kind of, do you see a lot of threads with his previous films, or do you see it as something very different for him?
People have been saying all sorts of things. You could say that his work has been building towards this, that this is his magnum opus. You know, you can draw a line back to perhaps Dunkirk or like Interstellar because of the science. And I just think it's an extraordinary achievement. He is incomparable, you know. He is totally unique filmmaker.
And you first kind of met him doing your audition for Batman Begins, uh-huh. Is that right? And so was that kind of nerve-wracking when you think back to that?
It was, but it was more exciting than nerve-wracking because I never considered myself to be the sort of perfect physical specimen for Batman, and I was just the opportunity to get to you know, work with him in a brief way, and they had built the whole set and it was all shot on 35, so it was a proper screen test, and it always felt to me like it should be Christian Bale, always. But then something happened in that test, and he gave me that other part in Scarecrow, and we just continued to work.
Also, in terms of iconic moments and things, people, even if they're not that familiar with Oppenheimer, everyone kind of knows that famous quote from the Bhagavad Gita that he sort of famously recited. Did you imagine that that's what it's like when actors have to say, like, Bond, James Bond or something when they have to deliver that line?
Yeah, maybe, but like, and we all knew that that line would have to be in there in some shape or form, but I think the way Chris has introduced it is very, very clever because it takes a lot of the air out of it, you know? I mean, it's still incredibly important, but we didn't talk about it too much when I was delivering it. He didn't direct me very much. We kind of both knew what it meant.
Were there sort of times on this film where were you thinking that people don't really get opportunities to do this, like on this kind of scale, this type of film? Was that something kind of at the forefront of your mind?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, but when you're shooting it, you can't really think about that. You know that Chris is going to present this in his own unique way, and he's going to be presented on IMAX and shot on these huge, and displayed on these huge cameras. But you just got to think about your work that day and the truth of what you're doing.
With such a complicated protagonist as Oppenheimer, was it beneficial to you to have someone like Killian who you already had such an established relationship with?
I think, you know, freedom of dialogue, a lack of ego, these kind of things that you get with a long-standing, you know, 20-year working relationship, they're an advantage whatever you're doing. You know, if you're on a boat in Dunkirk and you're saying, okay, can you go stand on that upturned hull in the middle of the ocean? Killian's like, yeah, I'm game, you know. The challenge in Oppenheimer was a very specific one. I handed him a script that was written in the first person. You know, I sit down at the table, I do this, I do that. He knew reading it that it's like, oh, we're taking this on for the whole world, for the whole audience. It's like, you got to see things from this guy's point of view. What I knew that Killian has is, as one of the great actors, he has this empathetic ability to open his thoughts and his feelings to the audience, so that we go with him. We look into those eyes, we feel we understand him, and we go with him.
You've said before that you don't kind of write scripts with actors in mind because of it being potentially limiting. But when you'd finished this, how did you kind of go about assembling that cast that sort of is around Killian in this film?
The magnitude of the story demanded, I always knew that I was going to want to put together the biggest and best possible cast. Oppenheimer's the center, you know, I'm finished with the script, I'm looking at the cover of American Prometheus, this incredible photograph of the real J. Robert Oppenheimer staring out with this intense blue-eyed stare, and I'm like, okay, I know who can do that. Having got Killian on board, I then start saying, okay, the relationship with General Groves, absolutely key, you know, who can do that hard ass, but with the sort of sincerity and kind of genuine quality that Oppenheimer would gravitate to, because these guys have to, their relationship was key to the Manhattan Project. Matt Damon, who I've worked with once before and really was looking for a chance to work with again, just perfect. Louis Strauss, a very complicated relationship with Oppenheimer. I felt like Robert Downey Jr. as one of the great actors of his generation, not just great movie star, but fabulous actor, to get him to come on and lose himself in the truth of this very complicated character. Similarly, the other people in Oppenheimer's life, there are so many of them, but it's his wife, Kitty, played by Emily Blunt, very, very contradictory and complicated character in her own right. Their relationship was baffling to the outside world, and I wanted to take people inside that so they understood it. His obsession with Jean Tatlock, played by Florence Pugh, you know, we needed somebody like Florence who had the poise, the charisma, and the massive talent to haunt him and stay with him through his life. Those were the kinds of conversations and thinking that went into it. But I think once I had Killian on board, it's a film called Oppenheimer. They're all seeing what's going to be at the center of it. And Killian has many, many admirers in the film community.
And this is your first film since Insomnia to be rated R or 15 in the UK. Did you sort of realise from the outset that this was going to kind of be a necessity for this film?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we just talked a little bit about Jean Tatlock, you know, in particular, but Oppenheimer's sexuality, you know, who he was as a person and how that expressed itself, is a very, very important part to understanding both what motivated him, what pushed him, you know, how he thought, but also the obsessions that ultimately had tremendous consequences in his later life for him and by proxy, frankly, for the entire world. It was very important to tell his story in a fully realized sort of valid way. And so when I brought the project to the studio, they knew the length it was going to be and they knew that it was going to be R-rated. I was very clear about that. Yeah, it was something we definitely anticipated. We're just dealing with a very serious and complex subject, and I didn't want to have to shy away from any aspect of it.
And do you see it as a bleak film? Like, do you see it as kind of, especially in comparison to your previous films?
You know, I was talking about this earlier, and it's an interesting analogy for me with Dunkirk. When I was making Dunkirk, I knew that as a British person, the emotion, the freighted emotion of that story, of that sort of national story that we have, that you grow up with, is so extreme that what I decided to do in the telling of it was to really play against that and have relatively anonymous characters, not specifically emotional situations, to make a sort of objectively intense film, trusting that the emotion of the story is so great just inherently in what it is that it would actually be sort of, in a way, almost magnified by that. And I think I've done something similar in a similar vein with Oppenheimer in that the darkness of the story is so inherent in just what the atomic bomb is and what it's meant for the world that in really pushing against that in the film and trying to find the suspense, the fun, the excitement, the incredible relationships, the story is so dramatic, his real story, that I get to kind of play with all that and just push as hard as you can in that direction. But I think the underlying darkness is undeniable, and by the end it overwhelms the film. And it's hard to explain that mechanism exactly, but it feels appropriate. It feels like what the story should always be.
And what genres did you have in mind when you're putting it together? Because I read you say about noirs and all your films being noirs to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And also there's certain moments where you think of like a heist movie when they're sort of pulling yeah. together the Manhattan Project.
Well, I think the middle of the film is definitely a heist movie. I mean, really, the shifts of the storytelling are, you know, the first act is kind of an origin myth. I mean, you've got this character who's experiencing visions, if you like. He's able to look into dull matter and see vibrating energy that he wants to harness in his thought process. He's a sort of almost like an apprentice magician or a Jedi Knight or something, you know. So you're kind of on that journey of self-discovery with him. And then in the middle of the film, we shift gears into a very intense heist film scenario, as you say. It's about a race against the Nazis to be the first to harness the power of the atom and thereby win the war. And that's a very, very compelling tale. What happens afterwards, which is going to be quite surprising for a lot of the audience members, you get this incredibly suspenseful tale of espionage and courtroom drama and all sorts. And so, yeah, there is a continual sort of shift in genres through the film.
And just a final very quick question, but do you see it as like an outlier in the summer season kind of compared to sort of standard blockbuster fare?
That's a hard question to answer because I'm, you know, somebody who've watched films my whole life and loved films and studied the history of films and just always immersed in it. And this film is absolutely in the tradition of what big summer blockbusters can be, or, you know, ways in which you can engage with an audience and you know, take them on a journey. But it's been a while since this type of film, you know, has been put out there, really attempting to do that. There's been a bit of a separation over the years of, if you like, you know, entertainment from serious drama that's kind of awards worthy or whatever. Over the history of movies, there have been so many amazing films that don't make that distinction. They just go, you know, this is a giant story that affects the entire world and always will. This man changed the world, like it or not, for all time. And so you've got to tell his story in the biggest scale possible. And it's the most dramatic and intense story that I know of. So on that basis, we humbly offer it, maybe not so humbly, but we offer it to the audience to be entertained by or not. And the word entertainment is complicated in regards to such a dark subject matter. But entertainment in cinema is about engagement. That's why you can be entertained by a horror movie, you know, or a set of appalling events, just the same as a comedy or a romance. This film is a lot of different things, but hopefully the thing that unites it is consistently engaging.
So there is Christopher Nolan and Cillian Murphy talking about Oppenheimer. For those of us who may not be aware of who Oppenheimer is and his considerable influence on world events, Matt, you've read the book, you did the cover feature twice with Nolan, you've been in the sound design with him, sitting at the back whilst he calibrates his film. Tell us who Oppenheimer is and what period of his life this film covers.
Yeah, so as you've explained, I'm sort of not the most objective, perhaps, Oppenheimer viewer, simply because I've obviously had all this background with it. I read the huge book on which it's based as part of my sort of research prep for the features. But basically, this film is based on the book American Prometheus by Kai Bird and Martin J. Sherman, which is just this sort of epic biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer, also known as the father of the atomic bomb. And that book covers like his whole, like, literally starts with, you know, it's like his parents' background and his childhood and goes sort of all the way through. Whereas this doesn't take quite as wide a look at his life. But we're basically looking at both the young Oppenheimer's life from his time as a sort of quantum physics student to his role in the Manhattan Project developing the atomic bomb. And then there's kind of a dual timeline approach, you could say, where...
What a surprise for Christopher Nolan.
Well, I know, that will surprise people. Yeah. So it's classic Nolan narrative mischief here. And there's also a sort of parallel timeline where we're looking at him further in the future, where he's being sort of kind of investigated in a hearing, and his sort of his loyalty to the United States of America, I guess, is being called into question due to sort of Communist Party connections he had in his youth and how things went for him after the atomic bomb. He's kind of his security clearance is being questioned. So we're also effectively, I mean, it wasn't truly a trial, but we're effectively seeing him on trial in that later stage of his life. So we're kind of cutting between those two timelines with a bit of jumping about as well with flashbacks and things, and referencing back to one of Nolan's previous films, Memento, where that had this black and white combination to sort of separate these different story strands. This has it's not done in exactly the same way, but you know, it's him back with black and white, and obviously this being Nolan, it's shot in like large format IMAX film cameras, so they actually sort of had to develop, you know, pardon the pun, this new film for the black and white IMAX. For the press screenings that we attended, you were able to see it in that full IMAX presentation, which obviously is only available really in a handful of locations, that full IMAX experience. But yeah, there's a few locations around the country you can see it, like there, if you want to see the absolute, you know,
the biggest
as it was intended to be seen. And it is does look so huge when you actually get those full IMAX shots, because as with previous films, there's a bit of a mix of like the full IMAX and the large format film.
So you're talking IMAX film, you're talking the biggest thing, that's very Nolan. We're talking, he has done history before when he did Dunkirk, so this isn't a new thing. We're talking time hopping, we're talking regular cast members. He's using Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer, you know, there's Kenneth Branagh popping up again, and then a whole host of other people are in this. I mean, do you want to start counting off the people who are in this? We've got Matt Damon as military brass, who is trying to corral an entire world of scientists. We've got Emily Blunt as Mrs. Oppenheimer. We've got Florence Pugh as Oppenheimer's lover. Who else is in this? I mean, who isn't in this, right?
Yeah, it's sort of ludicrous. Like the other big name who's one of the key supporting roles is Robert Downey Jr., who plays Lewis Strauss. He's the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. And so those are the real key supporting roles. But then, I mean, it's just, where do you even begin really with just the supporting cast? So there's Josh Hartnett in a supporting role, Rami Malek in a supporting role, Benny Safdie, quite a key pivotal role. Alden Ehrenreich has quite a key role. Matthew Modine, Jason Clarke has a notable role here as well. Tony Goldwyn. Everywhere you look, you kind of all recognize someone. Olivia Thirlby, Jack Quaid, you know, they pop up. Tom Conti pops up briefly as Albert Einstein. You've kind of seen him in the trailer, you know, and there's a couple of other people I didn't even realize were in it, so I won't kind of mention those. But Dane DeHaan's in it as well. It's just like, it's just everywhere you turn, there's a sort of recognizable actor that you will recognize from somewhere else, basically.
So very starry, very big, intended as an event movie, intended to get bums on seats. Do you think it's going to do it? It's quite a impenetrable subject matter. You know, people do spend a lot of this movie discussing quantum physics and mathematics, and not in a easily digestible way either. There's no sort of backpedaling on the complexities of the science they're talking about, or the very sort of murky moral and ethical dilemmas that they're facing. A lot of chat. Now, for my money, Christopher Nolan doesn't put his chat very high in his sound mix. I know you were in the sound mix, and I found that a bit of a problem, because it has all that classic, very deep, rumbling sort of narrative music that overlays this, that literally you can feel in your ass in your chair, because it's so, if it's on a really good sound system, it's got all that. It's got that insistent sort of ticking clock motif that we heard in Dunkirk. And I struggled to really grasp some of this very complex dialogue. How did you find it?
We've sort of briefly discussed this outside of the podcast, but I didn't have this problem with this film. I don't know, again, how much that comes from the sort of the background knowledge I had from sort of reading the book and doing the features and things. But I didn't find that a problem. I didn't find hearing the dialogue a problem at all. As you say, it's kind of intense, and as Nolan, like, never lets up, never kind of stops and slows it down for the sort of, you know, people in the back who aren't fully paying attention. It kind of grabs you, and you've got to go along with it. And what I really liked about it, to be honest, was this makes me sound like a bit of a philistine, but a historical biopic to me always has a chance to be boring, basically. There's always like, if this wasn't Nolan directing it, I would probably think to myself, well, sounds a bit boring. But the way it kind of introduces you to him and his life, it just doesn't start slowly at all. It literally like kind of throws you in right at the beginning. We kind of, you know, meet him as a student, and where he's got all these kind of, you know, ideas bursting around his head. Just kind of throws you straight into it. So there's just no like, there's no kind of like slow build up, no kind of slow getting to know the family. You're just in, and you're just sort of learning all these things about him and his contemporaries as you go along. As kind of discussed in the interviews, obviously it's very much like Oppenheimer's perspective. It's very much a sort of subjective film, really, where we follow him on this journey. And for all that cast, it is kind of Cillian Murphy carrying the whole film really on his shoulders. He's in sort of virtually every scene, and sort of it's all really, you know, from Oppenheimer's point of view. So in that sense, again, it's hard because I can't sort of, you know, separate the fact of having read the book from seeing the film. And I'm genuinely very interested to know what sort of, you know, general audiences will make of it. But I sort of felt because there was just such a big task at the center. Everyone knows about the atomic bomb. Everyone at least has some passing name familiarity with the Manhattan Project, even if you don't know much about the inner workings or anything. All those main characters, particularly Matt Damon, Robert Downey Jr., Emily Blunt, Florence Pugh, they're sort of so well cast that I felt that you just got those characters, even if you would struggle to perhaps like pass a test afterwards on like exactly what their job title was and exactly what, you know, year they first met Oppenheimer. But to me, I sort of felt like it glided along, and you know, there's this kind of, obviously you're building up to the creation of the atomic bomb, so there's just this one big task and target that it's all focused around, and obviously it's creates such sort of moral quandaries and things as well, and obviously, you know, creates powerful feelings in, you know, us and the characters, obviously. That I felt like that drove it all along. But like I say, obviously I can't separate the fact I had obviously read the book beforehand. So
yeah, I hadn't read the book, and I obviously had a passing knowledge of it. I was aware of his involvement. I was aware of the project and Trinity and Los Alamos and all of that sort of thing. So what I liked about it was also what I kind of didn't like about it. It's a very cold film, and Nolan is often accused of being cold. So I didn't feel that I liked many of the characters in this. I didn't warm to them. But I also liked that they were all, every single person was incredibly complex, and that he managed to bring across their complexities. Oppenheimer, he's a man who is a philanderer, he's called at one point, but he's also incredibly intelligent. He cares not a fig about his wife's feelings while conducting an affair, but at the same time cares immensely about the fact that he's basically killed 100,000 people in one go. He seesaws madly into two extremes, and he is a paradox, and that's very interesting. Equally, Kitty, played by Emily Blunt, is a woman who is incredibly supportive, but also very judgmental. She is somebody who isn't a natural mother, and yet is very nurturing in some other ways, and has a sort of mama bear protectiveness about her family, but cannot do that with a baby. You know, Florence Pugh's Jean is this very, very fiercely intelligent woman who is absolutely goes toe-to-toe with Oppenheimer and is able to sort of compete with him, and yet incredibly fragile as well in other respects. So all of them, and that's just those three. Everyone, Matt Damon's Brass is like this guy who is, you know, Mr. Military, but also fully aware of his job at hand, but fully aware of how, you know, flawed humans are, and we're trying to do something that is almost a godlike task. So all of that I thought was really interestingly explored. I just wish I could have heard it better in the mix. You're right, you know, this propulsive nature of them. Essentially, most of the film is, will they manage to do this bomb? Which we all know that they will. So it's a it's a fact that we're getting at, that it's like watching Titanic. Can we get, you know, anxious about a boat that we know will sink? And yes, the answer is yes. You are on the edge of your seat wondering if this implosion that they're about to create will actually work and what that means for the world. So that was good. But actually, it's a weird thriller at the end that you don't realize you're watching. So you think you're watching one thing, and at the end, it becomes something entirely different. And that was a bit that I found supremely exciting. There's something akin to Amadeus in this film that I really, really enjoyed and would have liked to have explored more of. And it's about pettiness and competitiveness and dick swinging that is really, really interesting when you're putting that inside a film that is about a world-changing event and a super weapon, a weapon of mass destruction that is going to change the course of history, that within that is this really interesting dynamic going on between two people that I really liked.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I thought was interesting about it as well, that I kind of briefly discussed this in the interview, that it sort of toys with different genres a bit. And so that's another thing. Again, I'm interested to see what general audiences make of it. But, you know, it's a bit of a heist movie at one point where it feels that they're assembling this kind of crack team for the Manhattan Project. And then you get a sort of courtroom drama element to it as well. And then, like you said, there's just the kind of a bit like how you have with Dunkirk, but where there's that propulsion that feels more like a thriller than a normal historical biopic. And I would not say this is one of those films, I wouldn't say it quite crossed over into horror, but there's some sort of startling moments in it as well. And I suppose just a lot of, you know, dark thoughts really as well. It's quite grim in that sense, you know, it's quite intense really. It's interesting that, again, maybe this is part of the reason why it captured the public imagination so much, with Barbie and Oppenheimer coming out on the same day, that you can draw parallels. And in some ways, I do think they make for like an interesting double bill. But obviously on the surface level, they are just so different, where one is sort of bright and frothy and fun, and the other is like kind of intense and dark and
serious.
But
they are both about existential crises or crises, should I say, to some degree or another. One is about a doll and one is about, you know, weaponry.
It's a lot of film, I would say that about Oppenheimer. And like, you know, you mentioned the sound design earlier, but I didn't have the problem with the dialogue, but I was sort of, there's a couple of moments of sound design where I was just absolutely startled. Like I kind of almost like jumped out of my seat, and I've actually sort of seen it twice. And the second time I watched it, this was one bit I'm sort of thinking of, I kind of braced myself for it, and it made me almost jump even more the second time, because you know, when you try and like prepare yourself for something and you kind of makes it worse almost. So yeah, that there's, and just in terms of like, yeah, that the sort of scale of the visuals, like if I had one qualm with Oppenheimer, which just to show that I can be somewhat objective when it comes to Nolan films, is this, because it does the thing where it kind of goes between the full IMAX and the sort of large format film, I found that slightly more noticeable than I have on previous films where it's done that. And I don't know if that's because this is less of an action film, so it is more of a drama, it is more based around people talking. Obviously some huge moments, some huge visuals, and some, you know, massive vistas and things like that, but ultimately, you know, you're not looking at big action scenes here, obviously, like you were in, for example, The Dark Knight. I found that because when you get this such a huge IMAX image, it's so crisp and clear. And that then when you go to the other film, it almost looks a bit grainier, and it's got that kind of, you know, grainy film texture to it. So I just felt like I was more aware of that changing than I had been when, and I know some people said it about the previous films, but it never really kind of sort of bothered me in the previous films. And it wasn't enough to, you know, really sort of detract from the film for me. But that was one qualm I had with this one.
Having said that you, you know, we're saying these are two excellent films, which order do you see them in? Do you go Oppenheimer, Barbie, Barbie, Oppenheimer?
I mean, this is really tough if we're talking about, if you're double billing it.
Yeah. You want 5 hours, you're going to need to get all your snacks in, you know, get your hydration sorted, going to need your different outfits for those as well. Yeah. You know, you're going to need pink for Barbie. I think more so somber colours for Oppenheimer, really. Tweed, if you will.
If you're going to go back to back, if you're literally going to watch one and go straight into the other, you know, that kind of double bill, I would say do Barbie first and then go into Oppenheimer.
I'd say the other way around.
I think it's, Oppenheimer's so intense and so full on. And I left feeling like kind of stunned in sort of every sense, and like my sort of head felt like it was swimming a bit afterwards. So I just wouldn't have, I personally wouldn't have wanted to go straight into Barbie afterwards. But I would flip it if you had time to, you know, go and have like a little break and like go out for dinner or something in between and then come back. If you could do that, I would flip it the other way around.
I'd go Oppenheimer first. I'd wear like something like a, you know, dark and somber and watch that and feel a little bit at a loss with man and his creations. And then I would rip that dark shirt off and be wearing my pink, and I'd go into Barbie and I would find myself joyous about man's creation and also slightly more hopeful than I came out of Oppenheimer.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
But do what you will. But we are saying they're both worth watching. Are we saying they're both worth watching? I mean, for my money, I think Barbie's going to entertain a far greater tranche of people than Oppenheimer. I think people will find Oppenheimer challenging. Some might say boring. And it might not be for everyone. I think everybody could find something in Barbie.
I think if I had to, obviously for me, if I had to pick one, I'm picking Oppenheimer. And I think as well that Oppenheimer is going to be, out of these two films, the one that stands the test of time. And in sort of 10, 20, 30 years time, I think people will still be kind of talking about it and it will still be sort of important. Whereas I think Barbie will maybe be a bit more forgotten about in a couple of years time. But both
that
are
depends
enjoyable
if and... it gets a franchise, Matt. We might be on Barbie 6.
But I think if they do a sequel to Barbie, that's going to feel a bit forced. It just works nicely as it is. I don't think it screams out for a sequel more than any film that just makes a lot of money screams out for a sequel. I think Oppenheimer will stand the test of time. Barbie's obviously great fun in the moment, but ultimately I genuinely am really pleased that with all this kind of, I feel a bit bad, you know, for the filmmakers in a way, because the film's just been, they've just been so intertwined because of this, you know, release date clash, two such different films. That obviously this Barbenheimer discourse has sort of dominated the online chatter, that they haven't really obviously had a chance to sort of stand on their own. But I'm sort of pleased that they're both very good, basically. So I feel like it would be sort of sad if after all this, one of them was just a bit rubbish and that the other one was clearly better and clearly the one film to see. But to me, it's like, definitely try and find time to watch them both.
Yeah, 100%. Definitely. That's I would say you need to see them both. If nothing else, then to have the Barbenheimer conversation. Mm. But equally, that they do weirdly inform each other in ways you wouldn't imagine. And also, you never know, come awards season, we might be seeing them going head to head. Cillian Murphy, definitely a shoe-in for an awards nomination. So I would say it's Robert Downey Jr. Emily Blunt as well, I would think, might be in a supporting thing. Mm. I wonder if, you know, Ryan Gosling's Kennedy could bring him some action. Who knows?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I 100% think Cillian Murphy, I think he's got to be the one to beat now from this point onwards. I genuinely thought his performance
was amazing. Killers of the Flower Moon is still to come. I think you'll find there's some contenders there.
I mean, talking at this early stage, I mean, like in terms of what's out now, he to me is the one to beat, just because I thought he did such a good job of the different, even just the different age ranges as well, you know, like that we're sort of slipping between. Yeah, so to me, he's a nailed-on nominee. And then, yeah, like you say, I kind of agree with all those others, really. I could see it getting a lot of nominations across the board, really. Technical categories, obviously, as well, like Hoyte van Hoytema's cinematography. And I haven't had time to mention it, but Ludwig Göransson's score, I just thought was just absolutely gorgeous as well in Oppenheimer. The sort of, you know, the strings aspect of it. And then also you get this just obviously much more intense aspect as well. So yeah, just from a craft perspective, yeah, I think it was an incredible achievement.
Yeah, I mean, Cillian Murphy should get an award for his eyes, really, alone.
Yeah.
Astonishing, the emotion that plays across those big blue orbs that are on screen a lot of the time. When you're watching it in IMAX, those are very big eyes. And yet, what he manages to do just with his eyes alone is incredible. We've always known he was great, but I think this really does showcase his talents. It's probably Murphy's year, I reckon. I think we'll be talking about him when it comes to Oscar season. Okay, so we're highly recommending both Oppenheimer and Barbie. I know which one you're going to go and see if you had to choose one. I would choose Barbie if I had to choose one, but I think don't choose just one. Yeah. Definitely go out and see them both. And especially with the actors currently on strike and writers currently on strike, because they want to be appreciated for what they actually bring to cinema. And it's not just about the backing money of studios. Go out and see these films and show studios that you value the work of these artists, because if they don't see that money rolling in for that support, then they won't understand how important it is what they contribute. So that's my little tuppence worth. That's my little soapbox moment at Hyde Park Corner.
Yeah. No, I agree. And just think, because obviously we are all so invested in cinema and just love cinema, the movies, etc. You know, there is something just great about having so many people talking about two cinema releases and getting excited about going to cinema. Just people just getting excited about a double bill is like a nice thing to me. And especially as like they're both not obvious subject matters as well. So obviously Barbie's based on a big sort of known intellectual property, a huge brand, but it's not obvious terrain for a film. And then similarly, Oppenheimer is like not obvious terrain for sort of, you know, the summer blockbuster season, as discussed in the interview as well. So there's something nice that it's those two films that are causing this conversation rather than, you know, just two more obvious superhero films.
Number six of a franchise.
Yeah, exactly. A great weekend to go to the cinema.
Yes, it is. And if the weather's not as good as it is at the moment, then it's an even better reason to go to cinema and sit in the dark. Mm. So Oppenheimer and Barbie are out in cinemas on Friday. See them with the greatest sound system you can and on the biggest screen you can. Right. A reminder that if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing to it. If you press a button now, you're all set for future episodes. And speaking of future things, what's coming out today, Matt? What is out on show?
So, I mean, again, if you just didn't need to be any more excited about cinema this weekend, then there's the new issue of Total Film magazine as well is dropping, featuring Gareth Edwards, the creator, on the cover. And it also fits into what I was just saying about this being non-obvious films, but this is another film that's like huge, exciting, but it's like an original sci-fi idea. It sort of feels in a way like a blend between Gareth Edwards' first film, Monsters, which was sort of really low budget and sort of resourceful and ingenious. And then he's obviously done these huge blockbusters, Godzilla and Rogue One. So it feels like this has the sort of the ideas and the sort of attitude almost of Monsters, but that massive scale that he sort of worked in since. And again, yeah, it's another chance just to sort of, you know, take a punt on a more original film. And reading Jamie Graham's cover feature, sort of, he did all the interviews for it. It got me, I was looking forward to the film, but it just genuinely got me so excited for the film. Also in the issue, like, I spoke to some experts about movie AI to find out, you know,
terrifying,
if we should really be scared of Skynet right now. So that sort of ties into the theme of the creator and AI.
And also very pertinent right now, because AI is a huge concern for the striking actors at the moment.
Exactly. A huge talking point this year. And then we've also got DC's Blue Beetle, Harris Dickinson's in there, Past Lives, which we'll talk about on a future episode of the podcast, but that's one of my favorite, very favorite films of the year so far. Ben Wheatley talks about, with you, Jane, about his career from, you know, these low budget, gnarly sort of British thrillers to doing like the biggest sort of scale blockbuster with Meg 2, The Trench. And also my set report from Gran Turismo is in this issue, and there's
so
loads of good stuff. So if Barbenheimer gets you excited about going to the cinema and watching films again, this will give you plenty more to look forward to.
Yes, indeed. That is out on sale on newsstands, out or down at your local supermarket or at your newsagents right now. Right, that's all we have time for. Matt will be back next week to rate Talk to Me, The Beanie Bubble, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and the re-release of Virgin Suicides. But before we go, it's time for listeners' question. What song, when you hear it, always takes you to a specific scene in a movie?
Well, this is probably a film I mention a lot on here, but just this is the first one that springs to mind because it was a soundtrack I just listened to absolutely loads in my youth. But it would be the song Kissing You by Desiree from William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. It just takes you straight back to that sort of fish tank scene and party scene. And yeah, that was the first thing that sprung to mind when you asked that, just because, yeah, that's film and soundtrack just holds such a place in my heart.
Yeah. Any of the songs by Sufjan Stevens for Call Me By Your Name really evokes a feeling of watching that film, which in itself evoked a real feeling of being in the summer, eating fruit, drinking lovely wine in a European destination. So when I listen to that, I think of the film, but I also think of that lovely feeling of being on holiday. And I will be on holiday next week, so I will be listening to it whilst eating my Greek salad.
Nice.
Okay, so on that note, we should probably say goodbye. Say goodbye, Matt, and you'll be back next week.
Bye, see you next week.
Bye, won't see you next week.
Hiya, Bobby.
Hi, Ken.
You want to go for a ride?
Sure, Ken.
Jump in.
I'm a Barbie girl in the Barbie world. Life in plastic, it's fantastic. You can brush my hair, undress me everywhere. Imagination, life is your creation.
Come on, Barbie, let's go party.